Sunday, the last day of July, the rest of us gave no anxious thought to church, for the Catholic contingent, Vicky and Simon and Pat, with Lucy rushing to make it, Pat probably has a lifetime of that ahead of him, were off to a 10 o'clock Mass, while Lyndon and I and Bill and June and Bill Deason and Jeannie, John and Ashton, gathered in a slow and leisurely fashion around the breakfast table in the big room that looks down into the valley where one of the great battles of the Civil War was fought. Lyndon read out loud to us the New York Times Magazine story by someone none of us had ever met, who had not interviewed a member of the family or anybody in our press office or anyone we can identify. It was not as lethal as I had feared it would be when Liz had told me that upon reading the first draft, her blood pressure had reacted in a way that sent her to Dr. Travail and thence to bed for 2 days. We sound country, perhaps like a soap opera family, but the calm judgment of Bill White was that a stranger reading it would think it was a plus for the Johnsons. I went to the bowling alley with Pat, and the Whites and the Deasons and Simon and Vicky and the Ganellas joined us, and my game made up for yesterday's awful ones, 133 and 110, and that self-satisfied feeling that comes of being fairly competent at something. We were deluged with news of the wedding today. A spread in the Star with a color picture of Lucy and Pat walking hand in hand past the fountain. One I read with a sinking heart, where Betty Beale reported that the King of Morocco is sending 4 caftan ensembles made to Lucy's measurements. We haven't seen or heard of them, but it would not make good reading for the opponents of foreign aid in the Congress. Another story, this in Parade, about Lucy's mail and gifts, inevitably entitled They Love Lucy, that was really rather charming. From Pune, India to Eden, Texas, the plain people of the world have deluged Lucy with songs, poems, recipes, advice, and congratulations. One of the most startling letters was signed by Pat Nugent. He wrote from Anaconda, Montana. Another Pat Nugent, this one from Philadelphia, turned out to be only 7 years old, and the letter was written by his seventh-grade sister, who reports that her brother is really taking a ribbing because of his name and doesn't appreciate the importance of the similarity. And a dear one from Cincinnati, I am writing this note to congratulate you on your upcoming marriage and to commend you on the upholding of the reputation of the American teenager. You have not only caused a new warm light to fall on us, but you have also forced older Americans to look upon us with seriousness as well as humor. Some humorous cartoons of 3 of us semi-principals, me, Liz, and Bess. With this one-sentence summary I liked, Bess has a southern graciousness that never sags under the magnitude of pressures of her job. And then the news that Lyndon read with great ceremony. He has had the strangest long-term relationship with the Pope, entirely one way, for about the first 25 years. And these last few years, since his meeting with Pope John, a quite real relationship. The headline was, Pope May Bestow Wedding Blessing. Pope Paul VI is expected to bestow his personal blessing on the marriage of Lucy Baines Johnson and Patrick J. Nugent. Highly placed Catholic sources say the papal benediction probably will take the form of a warm, fatherly message to the bride and groom, which will be read by Archbishop Patrick A. Ball on the wedding ceremony at the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, August 6. Lucy, thoroughly inured to the total barrage of words now, was excited and shining-eyed about this. Marie Smith's story about Lucy and her wedding gifts recorded the practical ones from those who Zephyrus and Sammy's gift of a vacuum cleaner with all the attachments. A sewing basket from Helen, lined in gay quilted yellow chintz by Helen herself, complete with everything she'll need in her new life of keeping her own clothes in order. And the electric mixmaster from Willie Day and Ashton and Patsy. And the present I love most of all, the 6 sterling silver syllabub cups from Tony, initialed MLPT 1912, when they belonged to my mother, AJT, dated 1927, when he took them from the brick house to his home in Santa Fe, and LJN 1966. Somewhere along about 1 or 2 o'clock, a cloud began to gather on our horizon, signaled by the arrival for Bill Moyers, Joe Califano, and Lyndon's long absences on the telephone. I was not really aware what was going on, but one can sense a change in the atmosphere. Outside, the day was sunshiny bright, brisk weather with a touch of fall in the air. After bowling, I went up to the swimming pool, where Lyndon was in with the two delightful daughters of Commander Jones, Karen and Julie, aged about 3 and 5, and Bill Moyers and Joe Califano. It was a new conquest. Yesterday, Karen had shouted from her screen porch as we walked by, "Hello, Mr. President!" And Lyndon had responded immediately, "Hello, come out and give me a kiss." She was there in a twinkling, followed by her sister, blonde, brown-legged, immediately completely at ease with Lyndon and he with them. Lyndon had asked Dr. Davis to come up and bring his family and give us a little prayer. He arrived with his son, the medical doctor who'd been in service on a submarine for many months, and his daughter, Mrs. Winstead. We sat around the pool while I took moving pictures, and then, despairing of getting anyone to go home and have lunch, asked the staff to bring the hamburgers and beans and fruit salad and iced tea to the pool, which we did. And everybody ate ravenously about 3 o'clock. Afterwards, Dr. Davis gave us a brief prayer and presented Lyndon with a plaque dated many months before, which made him the first honorary elder in the Christian church. It was somewhere along in the middle of the day that I learned what lay behind the cloud. The machinists in the union were not ratifying the agreement that their leaders had recommended. They were voting against it 3-1. The strike would not be ended. We had failed. The sweet taste of success turned bitter, and it looked as though the next few days would be a chess game between many forces from which Lyndon would have to try to wrest some public good with no path clear. We went back to Aspen, and he tried to take a nap, and I went into Linda's room for a long talk. She had plans to go job hunting in New York. Now, George Bundy had written her about an offer from the Ford Foundation, and McCall's had written her, and she had the possibility, suggested by Bill Moyers, of a job with National Geographic. And just when, I don't know, Arthur Goldberg had either written or talked to her about working for the UN. One that particularly appealed to her, but they have held out no offer so far as I know, was the American Heritage magazine. And then one that appeals as a safe harbor, but not exciting. It is an offer to work in the book collection at the University of Texas. Miss Hudspeth had talked to her about it. Linda is at a sort of crossroads. It is good that she has Warren Lynn for companionship and handholding. Later, I gathered up the few who had enough energy left, and we went bowling for a couple of more games, and back to Aspen for an early dinner, and then into the chopper by 8:30. There was so little I could do to lighten Lyndon's load. I could only tell him that there's no place in all the world, not the Grecian Isles, not the Virgin Islands, not any Shangri-La, that I had rather be this weekend, and with him at Camp David, with exactly the company we had. Back at the White House, I went to the pool and swam 30 laps, unsuccessful in getting Linda Bird and Warren Lynn to go in with me, and sending word in to Lyndon, who was continually on the phone, that I wish he'd join me. Then Linda and Warren Lynn and one of Linda's agents settled down for a good bridge game on the second floor, one of the things Linda and I are quite content to do for hours at a time. And then my greatest luxury, a massage. But sleep was the will of the wisp, in spite of all the exercise of this vigorous day and the fresh air and sunshine. And it was the restless night, the close of a weekend that had begun on a high and golden note and ended rather in a slough of despond. I often think that my very favorite quality in Lyndon is his ability to go doggedly on, looking, searching for some solution. I must read him those lines from The Man from La Mancha. To right the unrightable wrongs, to beat the unbeatable foe. This supreme pragmatist is in no way like Don Quixote, and yet somehow the lines are apt.